Hello, and welcome to this podcast version of Forsaken Chains, a crime detective novel of fiction presented to you in part, chapter by chapter. This podcast may contain mature themes, and discretion is advised. For more information, or to order your copy of the novel, send an email to forsakenchains@gmail.com. I am your host, Ronald Proshot, and you are listening to Forsaken Chains, read aloud by Margaret Jones Bricker. Now, here's Forsaken Chains by Ruth Langner.
It had been 3 weeks since Clarissa had last heard from her son, Andrew. It was not uncommon for him to set out for Vienna to take in a Mozart concert, or flit off to Paris for a weekend to attend a theater production, or visit a museum. Certainly, he never confessed all of his travels to her, but never would he have gone abroad for an extended period without leaving word. Never would he have left his office without making arrangements. That was quite inconceivable. She had gone into town to kneel in St. John Church, to hear the liturgy and the compassionate preaching of the priest, to be calmed by the wafting smoke of incense, and to pray for her son. Who wouldn't pray in their hour of need? Who wouldn't call on the Almighty, the Savior of souls? There was a time when spiritual reverence, the years of Christian sacrifice and martyrdoms, did command her belief, and she would have flung herself at the feet of Jesus and begged his intervention. But at the end of it all, she derived no relief from this ritual of the faithful, and now, gazing at Christ on the cross and the painting of the Last Supper, only made her more depressed. Her other son, Charles, called daily if he could not come by, and for this unfaltering loyalty, Clarissa was grateful. He had chosen the church and had become a clergyman. True, she had been disappointed he had not used his talents with a slide rule and followed her husband's path into engineering. All these years she had harbored a mild resentment against him that she kept well hidden in her heart. But above all else, there was no denying his devotion and morals were irreproachable. Yet how many times had she favored Andrew over Charles? In her weakened state, she admitted to idolizing Andrew much more so than Charles. How unchristian of her! She lowered her head, her cheeks burned as she felt humbled by her confessions. A framed photograph given her only last year rested on the round occasional table. It showed a man whose thick hair was beginning to gray as he approached midlife, with no sign of baldness, which suited him well. There, smiling sweetly beside him, was Genevieve, the daughter of a stockbroker. They had married when Charles was 28, and what's more, Clarissa had given her blessing. Their three daughters all adored their father and dutifully acknowledged her as their favorite grandparent. She'd never heard him speak unkind words, or become angry or prickly. He was a model husband, always thoughtful and kind, complimenting his wife and remembering special occasions. They lived in Tunbridge Wells, and Charles could often be seen walking the pleasant distance from his home to the rectory, devoutly robed in a cassock with the tattered pages of a Bible tucked under his arm. No two ways about it, for all his admirable traits, for all that he expounded to his congregation who worshipped him as much as the deity, she felt ashamed that she was not able to accept unreservedly that the path he chose was God's will. Days wore inexorably on. For long periods of time she sat looking out the window at raindrops bouncing into puddles like tiny pebbles, agonizing over a plethora of unconvincing theories that would explain Andrew's disappearance. Her heart wrestled with all manner of possibilities, ranging from suspicious conspiracies to complete fairy tales. In the end, she was not ready to admit that anything had occurred from which he would not return. One day, she awoke resolved, with renewed determination, to make inquiries. She dressed and descended the wooden staircase to the kitchen. Her plump cook was already busy kneading bread dough, her hands covered in flour. She examined Clarissa with a mixture of compassion and caring. "Tea, my lady?" she asked, while dusting her hands on her apron and turning on the kettle. "You must eat something. Look at you. You're withering away. Soon you'll be slipping through the cracks. I'll fix you up something right away." Clarissa uncoiled arms that were tucked around her body. Overnight, her thoughts had crystallized into a plan, and her appetite returned. She was calm and hungry and ate biscuits smothered with jam, a slice of cheese, and sipped at her tea. Shortly after breakfast, she left the house, having arranged for a taxi to take her into London to her son's flat. Andrew lived on the top floor in a spacious apartment of a five-story Victorian structure. The building was situated deep within a vast labyrinth of narrow streets, covered with leafy trees, lined with upscale shops and residences, within the borough of Kensington and Chelsea. The folks who visit the area don't get lost and disappear unwillingly was truly amazing, she mused. She opened the door to Andrew's suite carefully, to not disturb a single particle of dust, and then took off her gloves and laid them on the table, along with her handbag. She moved through all the sacred spots. Her fingers touched the linen napkins she had had pressed and given back to him and lighted briefly on the vellum writing paper on his desk that wedded him to his work. She read the spines of the books in his library, many cracked from being repeatedly opened. She sat down on a cushioned chair in the drawing room and rocked it gently, her brows knitted with recollections and sentimentality. At this moment, all she wanted was to cherish the feeling of her son's presence, to hear his voice, to see him, to know he was safe. She wept. She tried to disregard the despairing thoughts she carried. It would not do to brood. A miracle was not about to happen. She got up and went to the kitchen. Methodically, she removed any perishable food left in the crisper, packaged it up and placed it in a shopping bag to be relegated to the dustbin. Then she made her way to her son's barber, his banker, and even his clothier, the one she knew about. All would say they had not seen Andrew recently, or that when they last saw him, he showed no remarkable change. She expressed her frustration in being unable to elicit any information about her son, though her heart refused to accept anything more severe than he was missing. Once more, her hope for a miracle faded like the evening sun. There was nothing more she could do. She turned and walked down the higgledy-piggledy streets and into the cavernous main hall of the Metropolitan Police Station. The office of the Missing Persons Bureau occupied the smallest corner of the enormous building, signaling to Clarissa the lack of importance in the hierarchy of investigations. Inside the tiny room, she took a seat, one in a line of six, all wooden and hideously uncomfortable, and began assessing the space. Air, suffocating, still as a corpse and smelling of stale cigarettes. Her nose tweaked. She sat with her body stiff and upright. The window ledges were caked in old dust on which lay a few dead flies. She had no choice but to breathe, so reached into her handbag and withdrew a delicate scented handkerchief, which she held close to her lips. Clarissa was awed by the woman behind the counter, a biped with a long neck, small hands, and rather large protruding buttocks, quite possibly obtained from sitting on them too long. She eyed her critically. Behind every successful department head sits a humorless and meticulously anal drone who keeps the whole department afloat. If I am at her mercy, Lord help me, she thought. Bobbies in their navy blue jackets with polished silver buttons came in and out of the door, letting it close with a bang. Clarissa stared beyond them, waiting a humiliatingly long time, patiently, her hands folded in her lap. One constable looked at her, and for a moment she thought he would approach and ask if he could be of assistance. Instead, he looked at his watch and hurried off without a word. To compound her growing annoyance, a group of children had gathered in the corridor, chatting and giggling in a foreign language. Sounded Italian. She didn't care. She was astonished. No one reprimanded them. Why don't they just move on? Why aren't they in school? Surely they aren't about to report a missing person. Why, oh why, hasn't Andrew contacted me? Suppose he's met with an accident. Why must he forever be going off somewhere? It was almost 3 in the afternoon. She had been waiting 45 minutes when another woman who looked like an old snapdragon and whose name, according to the engraved plaque on her chest, was Miss P. Eberhardt, signaled her, waving a piece of paper in the air. "You need to complete this form first." Clarissa entered tick marks in a slew of tiny boxes on the checklist, and when finished, handed it to the clerk, who vigorously affixed a date stamp to the top right corner. She answered the abundant woman's many queries. "Yes, Andrew is an adult. I last saw him on October 12th. No, I've not heard from him. 5'8". Thick, dark brown hair, broad shoulders, even white teeth. Prosthetics? Surgical or cosmetic implants? How rude! No! Andrew had not mentioned travel abroad. His office had not heard from him either. He may have had his troubles, but he keeps them well concealed, at least from me." She was feeling fatigued. "Do you have a recent photograph of your son, Mrs. Thornton?" A lump formed in her throat. Clarissa reached into her handbag and pulled out a wallet-sized portrait image of Andrew taken at the ceremony of his admission to the bar, reflecting a solemn expression of that momentous event, and laid it gently on the counter. Miss Eberhardt callously stapled the sacred picture to the report. "How dare she treat my picture so heartlessly, the wretched, beastly creature," Clarissa thought quietly. "Is there anyone here of authority that I can speak with?" By now she knew not to expect an interview with the likes of a Holmes or Montalbano. "This is a very busy office. Our agents are all tied up. In all likelihood, your son will turn up. Kindly let us know if you hear from him. In the meanwhile, we will contact you if we find anything or require further information." Clarissa shot the clerk a disgusted look. She held herself erect. A dull hue settled on her face, and her voice sounded smothered with strongly repressed feelings. "Then I shall expect some positive news very soon." To expedite bureaucratic procedure would be futile. She already felt mortified by the process. "Our boys are worked to death in this department, but we do what we can." "I see. So much the worse for me." With that, Clarissa tapped her cane once and turned to leave. Her initial contact with the Missing Persons Bureau left her with a lingering impression that little would come of her effort, and that the Bonhomie chaps working in the department would not be clambering over each other to be assigned another file, adding to the hundreds already on their desk. For now, there was nothing more she could do. Filing the report on Andrew's disappearance exhausted her both physically and emotionally. She thought about hiring a driver to take her back to her home in Churt, but decided to walk in the city to let the cool air help calm her down. She made her way along the clotted streets just north of Westminster Station, away from the enormous grey stone building of Scotland Yard. The clock tower chimed out the half hour in F major. Her feet felt the rattle of the tube's trains departing from stations underground as she waited for her turn to cross. Down at the curb, brown weeds poked through crevices in the pavement. Above, exhaust fumes curled up in an exhaling plume, evaporating into the air. A police whistle blew and a hand rose to halt traffic gripping the center of the city. A motor car braked sharply to avoid hitting the one in front, causing heads to turn. A mother firmly clutched the hand of her young son, who was shaking his finger and pointing toward the driver. By his uniform, Clarissa could see the lad belonged to one of those short-pants-privileged private school leagues, reminding her of how Andrew had looked in his gray flannel trousers when he was that age. She continued on toward the Houses of Parliament. It wasn't long before she changed her mind. She wouldn't deign to stand on a street corner to flag down a taxi. Instead, she went to a nearby hotel in Whitehall Court, whose doorman kindly hailed her a coach and saw to it she was seated comfortably before closing the door. He leaned in and instructed the driver. "The lady's going to church. See that she gets there, will you, mate?" And with a tip of his hat to Clarissa, "Off you go then, love." The go-home traffic slowed their journey out of the city. She was glad the driver wasn't into polite conversation. Clarissa sat silently in her sadness, staring out at the sea of congestion that hammered its way along, throbbing like the pain in her head. The skilled driver pushed his way forward at a snail's pace up Baker Street until at last they were free of the mess and on the A3. Darkness had descended by the time they reached the outskirts of Churt, prompting Clarissa to recite specific directions to the driver. Her cottage was situated well back and could not be seen from the road in the dim light. The driver obligingly turned and drove through the open, massive, ornate wrought iron gates installed between two red brick pillars, inched his way along an avenue of elms, past the stables that had been spared destruction, kept as a reminder of Clarissa's equestrian passion for riding in her younger years, and parked at her door. "This will be fine." "Don't worry yourself, madam. I'm happy to assist you with your door." He passed around the front window of the car and brought the door open, standing strong and erect like a sentry. She fumbled in her handbag for her keys, handed the driver a generous amount of cash, tacitly grateful for his safe delivery, and managed a modest thank you. It was her habit to leave outside lights on when she anticipated being away for any length of time. Those and the pale lights that shone from the windows illuminated the footpath she followed around the cottage to the back, where she let herself in through the scullery. From here she could see, half hidden in the distance, standing guard on a knoll, the 18th-century stone house, Hensley Hall Manor, its white lights from the inhabited upper dormers faintly visible across the gardens. The extensive gardens and grounds to the north still retained their terraces and parterres, their serenity and beauty, the pride of the head gardener's cultivation. In the summer, the faithful roses stood magnificently, and seasonally placed perennials grew haphazardly in a true English country garden fashion. For years, the grounds surrounding Hensley Hall had been opened up for associations, such as the Cricket Club or the local Horticultural Society, to host receptions and solicit donations. Those were the glory days when society mattered, she recalled with a sigh of nostalgia. What to make of it all? Nowadays, there was no visitor's book, no men wearing smart suits, no women in fancy dresses, nor the tinkling of teacups. Even with the most prudent investing, the Spencer Thornton fortune would not last forever. What with land taxes continually eroding capital, and rooms worn out and once more in need of refurbishment. 5 years ago, Clarissa had relinquished her control over Hensley Hall to Andrew, who had taken on a full part in managing the family properties. He had already carved off a large chunk of land to the east and sold it for development. Soon the augers and diggers would interrupt the tranquility by creating an unpleasant invasion, transforming the land into small holdings, a stark betrayal of the true gentry's estate. All she had left was a brief communion with nature, alone in the garden. In the afternoons she ventured out for a walk along the path that stretched down to the pond, where frogs croaked from their resting spot atop the broad, abundant lily pads, and where colonies of dragonflies, obnoxious insects, and other aquatic larvae happily propagated. A lot of water had flowed down the stream since she had been a young girl riding her horse sprightly over these meadows. Time had taken its toll. It had all grown old and tired, like me, I suppose. She lit a candle and joined her hands in prayer. For Clarissa, the days passed in dreary succession, filled with worry and uncertainty, leaving a feeling of dread hanging like a dark cloud in the air. The notion that Andrew would suddenly walk through the door was slipping away faster than the ticking second hand on the clock. Clarissa was restless, anxious, and could not settle. Her eyes did not sparkle as they used to, and her face wrinkled as if in a perpetual frown. She fidgeted and fussed about in the drawing room, straightening the decorative objects and knick-knacks and rearranging flowers in their vases. That she had little energy by the day's end was no surprise. It was her children who gave her life reason. Her husband had died 30 years before, when Andrew was 18 and Charles 16, leaving her dressed in widow's weeds for a year and a day, and all these years since she had never considered remarrying. In the morning light, Clarissa stood motionless, gazing out of the wide window of her dining room, composing her stories, affirming her life's experiences, recalling her memories. She had not forgotten the tiniest details of Andrew's young life. He felt so soft and pure when she had cradled his tender newborn body in her arms. She remembered wiping his tears and cleansing his cuts and scrapes from falls. She sniffled, but her thoughts were clear, as though she was speaking to a friend who stopped by to visit. Andrew didn't play in the streets with the other boys. Instead, he sat reading about art, politics, and finances. At an early age, he knew all about Winston Churchill, Clement Attlee, and the dominant features of the Labour Party, and he recognized paintings by the great Renaissance masters, Da Vinci, Raphael, Michelangelo. The time came when Andrew no longer clung to her for his everyday support. Clarissa remembered how at 15 Andrew had come home and run upstairs to change his clothes, reappearing in a smart sweater and dress trousers, all polished up and looking dashingly handsome, a bottle of wine sequestered under his arm like a dark secret. He said the schoolmaster had invited him to dinner, and it wouldn't do to turn him down. After kissing her goodbye on the forehead, she had detected the odor of liquor on his breath, which had struck her as odd at the time, since he had shunned alcohol at home. It was always like that back then. When he moved on to university life, Clarissa discovered he was a different man. Andrew had no time for her anymore. He rushed off in a jovial mood to spend time with others, and Clarissa felt the loss of her son to the world beyond her grasp. When she reflected, she would admit that his father's death had been a turning point for Andrew, though she could not pinpoint just what had changed, only that he had appeared to withdraw from the family and their social activities. As the years passed and he found his own way, his priorities did not appear to include a wife, far less a grandchild. In this, life seemed bitterly unfair. Stop! Does my heart not ache enough? What would I not do to see Andrew walk through the door right now? Oh, God, how dreadful this all is! Why did Andrew not leave word with someone, anyone? She turned and left the window of her silent house and climbed the staircase away from the central hall, but had not yet reached her bedroom when she heard the telephone ring. She was out of breath by the time she reached the extension and picked up the receiver. She composed herself in an armchair and straightened her skirt before announcing her presence on the line, ending with an upward lilt in her voice. "Hello? Spencer Thornton residence?" "Hello, Mother, it's Charles. You sound dreadfully winded. Are you all right?" "Charles, darling, it's you. I am fine. Really, I am."
"Have you eaten?"
"Yes. Mildred made poached eggs today. I managed a few bites. Oh, Charles, I simply cannot cope, not knowing what has happened to Andrew. There's neither rhyme nor reason for his silence, and those wretched police are no help at all.
I had a dreadful time at the Missing Person Bureau.
Her lower lip quivered as she relayed her experience with Miss P. Eberhardt.
I could have driven you to the police, Mother. Why didn't you mention you were going?
Clarissa did not answer, but sighed deeply.
You must keep up your strength. I pray we will have news soon. Andrew did not just arrange to get lost. He may have met with an accident. Perhaps he's suffering from amnesia, under a doctor's care and unable to communicate. Or he is held up somewhere intriguing. It's not the sort of thing one just places an advert in the Telegraph for.
Charles spoke in a reassuring voice. But Clarissa suddenly became wild with fear.
What do you mean, lost? Accident? Amnesia? What if he is dead? She shrieked as she burst into a flood of tears like an apocalyptic weather event and crumbled into a heap.
If you would like to make a comment, you can do so right here in this website, or send an email to forsakenchains@gmail.com. The author is looking forward to hearing from you. This recording was made possible by the facilities of Arts North Digital Studio and Media in partnership with the Community Arts Council. Music for this podcast is taken from Di Maldau, composed by Bedrick Smetna and performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Come back soon for the next episode of this suspenseful novel and find out more with Detective McCauley of the Serious Crime Unit, Metropolitan Police, London, UK. I sure hope you have enjoyed this chapter. Thanks for listening.